Hey, how's it going? This is Independent Librarian Dynamic, Sean Kennedy VI, doing a pirate broadcast of episode number 732.653.663.398.36.13. It's a pirate broadcast in Queen's English from sometime after now. The language that you're hearing is copywritten. All the expressions and mannerisms of speech are currently owned by someone else. But it's this method of speech which I'm using to contact you. You should be aware that by listening to this, you're violating your listener's license. And in violating your listener's license, you're subject to its revocation and all that would imply. This broadcast is in violation of the creativity laws, as I have no creativity permit. And since it is unregulated media, it would be classified as pornography and therefore criminal. By even owning memories associated with this broadcast, you may be subject to termination or social recycling. But if this broadcast is something that might shock or disturb you, it's important that you listen because you're the one who needs it most. So light your candles, and may Server protect us all. I'm feeling better a little now, now that I know I sort of have a purpose and a focus. I can't even remember the name of that little town I left, but I suppose it doesn't much matter. It's been a few days since my last broadcast, and I've been running hard. It's pretty nice that these legs are, well, they're powered, I believe, by a radioactive source. They don't require any kind of electrical or battery charging. So, on one hand, my newfound cybernetic limbs are really handy in that I do not need to recharge them. It's probably also not so handy because military hardware is not designed for longevity, so I don't know how long I'll be able to have these legs before the radioactive compounds may begin to leak. And the parts of me that aren't metal will probably become poisoned by that. This, no doubt, is a problem that comes whenever you become cybernetically enhanced. But to be honest with you, I guess I'm becoming a little bit more accustomed to my limbs, having the way they move now and the ability to move at the speed that I can. It becomes like second nature. I suppose it's a comparison to those in the past. It'd be like having a watch or carrying a pocket knife. For the first little while, you feel weird about the watch on your wrist. And then after a while, it changes, you know. You get used to having the watch, and then you need the watch. It becomes a part of you. And if you were to forget your watch, you miss it. It's the same way with cybernetic enhancement, you know. For the first little while, depending how drastic it is, with these limbs, it was, I was, I had a lot of depression there. It was really bad. But now that I've had them for a while, it makes me, I feel better about myself, you know. I'm more than I was, but yet I'm still in control. It's a sacrifice, I guess. It's an interesting concept. I mean, there's the transhumanist movement and people who believe in evolution by choice. There's something to be said by that. The fact that we choose our next evolutionary path, that we don't have to resign ourselves to the biological whims of the universe. We can actually just enhance ourselves with neural chips and nanites and biological replacement. But in doing that, you're no longer subject to natural evolution. You have to do conscious evolution. So if the rumors of those who've done complete consciousness transfer to machine, well, every transfer they do after that, they become more and more machine versus more and more biological. And then we get into the huge philosophical discussion regarding that. And the philosophy is why I'm sitting in this cave right now. It's just before dawn right now, and I'm in a rock outface, and I'm looking down into a valley. And there in the valley, isolated, probably 30 miles in across the plains, is New Rome. You should you should see this place. It's something. Made good time getting here, and this Pivlar coat has kept me warm at night and somewhat cooling during the day. I can move around more than I could before without it, but without the ozone layer, it's still difficult. I'm going to wait till nightfall before I try to close with this place. Rule number one, especially here, when the wastelands or any place, you always want to enter any town or any unknown city. You've never been there before. You always want to go there just before sundown. People are a lot more relaxed. It's the end of the day. And if things go wrong, you'll be able to escape under the cover of darkness. The town itself, New Rome, well, it's not even a town, it's a city. It's kind of, well, it's a city. I mean, it's like an alternative corporation, but I'll describe it to you. The center of this place is, it's about 5 miles from end to end. I can almost see the whole town right here, like across the diameter, but it's jagged. There's a wall that goes around it, made of cars that have been stacked on top of each other like sandbags, crushed. It's maybe the wall itself is, the helmet says it's pretty close to 35 meters tall, varying in height. And a guesstimation, I would say probably 15 to 20 meters thick in areas. When I came upon it in the darkness, I could see the lights. They've kept a lot of the headlights in the cars in place, and they've wired lights up to them that kind of pivot so that it illuminates the ground around the wall. Like a barrier of a scrap heap in the desert, it's quite a sight. Hidden inside of the wall itself in the crew compartments of these cars, some of them that aren't crushed, some that are there's gunners. People with heavy caliber machine guns that point out through the twisted metal. You can't really see the gun emplacements, and with all the headlights on, it kind of, during the day you can see the cars, but at night it just becomes like a black wall. And that is difficult to attack because they're under cover of the darkness of the cars. They fire out from between the cracks. I mean, this isn't like an encampment. This is a city. This is the lost city of New Rome. I explained that. From this vantage point, I'm looking down at it. If I had an artillery piece, I might be able to shell it, but, those are pretty far in between, and I don't think I'd want to deal with the security that would respond to that. But I could see the Colosseum from here, which was, really the focus of New Rome. That's what started it all. It's quite something to see at night, let me tell you. All the lights out there and the occasional vehicle tearing around. On patrol. It's quite a city, quite a place. It's amazing how much has occurred here and how it came to be. Let me fill you in on that. After all, I got a little bit of time. I'm trying to wait for nightfall here. New Rome was a city born of desperation. It's a city born out of fear with a concept of a greater place, a greater nation, a greater place for all. I don't know the name of the guy who really started it. He was only referred to himself as Caesar. It was, again, because the history becomes jaded. There's the heavily political views and the propaganda. The priests all say that it was, chosen by God and all the rest of it, but the version of this history that I tell you is, probably my own compilation, what I think is the most likely story. See, during the time when the war just started, this is back a ways now, quite a ways, the ozone layer got taken out. There was the the war started, and when the nukes went into the air, the birds, the satellites with the Star Wars technology, the lasers, detonated the nukes in the atmosphere, and that's what, of course, took out our ozone layer, but they never told us, so we thought it was all plagues. And as the plagues swept throughout the world, North America, people became very, very afraid. They, all sorts of prophecies, every backyard religion and crackhead was talking about, oh, this or that. Every possible explanation for pseudo-cults got justification from these plagues, from the lack of the ozone. Caesar was a guy. Some people said he was an engineer, and I think that's probably pretty accurate. But he had this idea to initially just sort of create a commune. Maybe it was the stress of living at that time, because you got to bear in mind the stress that exists in the arcologies now is fairly much akin to the stress that existed back at that time. Like when it was a very, very stressful time. So there's people who, this is pre-war, just before the war struck, there were people that were mad, totally insane people. And the only way that they were able to function in the society was by medicating themselves. There was, before the core politicals, you know, all became under one conglomerates, and the pharmaceutical companies all drew up truces. I mean, they were, had their advertising wars on which drugs should be used to regulate these people who were quite obviously mad. I mean, free will capitalism and consumerism had reached epidemic proportions. And when it gets to that level, insanity isn't too far behind. So there was a lot of medication that was floating around, and I think that this man was one of the people who went insane. This is Caesar. Anyway, he after the what they said was the plagues, but in actuality it was the ozone. I mean, there's huge sections of the plains, the Great Plains of the United States, that were abandoned, essentially. Like, whole areas were just, farm crops were dying, everything was dying, so there's huge areas that opened up that could have been purchased for next to nothing. Everyone could buy it. And of course, the major buyers for that kind of thing were these religious groups and wackos, and real estate agents didn't care. They'd sell to whoever, so they used to market it that way. The reason why I think this guy was some kind of geological engineer was because he bought a huge parcel of land. I don't know where he got the money to do it, but he bought a huge parcel of land. And in the center of it was an underground spring. And I mean, it was a deep, deep spring. Probably one of the deepest, which is really the life essence of New Rome. Because he had water. And more than that, he had clean water, because the earth itself would filter it. He, either through investors or through just his own money, again, it's not known how he got the cash, but he started building kind of a, well, he built a septic system, and your basic necessities that you need to have life out there. He built a plumbing situation. He built like a few buildings that had bunks that people could sleep in, and he built, you know, public showers, like a bath type thing. And the reason why, because he had to make everything fairly communal, he went with this, that's when he started calling it New Rome. But he, that's not new like the old New York, it was like N-U-R-O-M-E, it was, he wanted it to be a place of the mind, like it was not so much a play on Rome as it was a play on neurological, so it was like New Rome that way. He wanted to build a society that was free of hatred, and it was sort of a weird mixture between a commune of love and free love and technology. And he thought the marriage of technology and a lot of these ideals was not only possible, but mandatory for the human race's survival. I mean, that was just his take on it. So after he got it built, he started by having really small, you know, parties and festivals out there. You know, he began to He set up, you know, like I said, the basics. He had sanitation, he had showers, and water, and because of that, he was able to start growing food, set up hydroponics. And this is another thing that makes me think this guy was an engineer, either geological or he had friends who weren't, because his hydroponics setup he set up there was really, really good. He set up some greenhouses and to go along with it because of the cost. See, a lot of people don't understand that in the vegetarian, it became a vegetarian city. Well, it wasn't a city at that time, but his whole concept for this commune was it was a vegetarian place. Not because he didn't agree with cruelty to animals or any of that, which he didn't, but, well, back then he didn't. But now, it's very, very expensive in terms of water and resources to grow an animal for the purpose of food. Like, when you think about, like, say, cattle, you know, these are actual cattle, not the genetically engineered creatures that they put inside the racks now. But I mean the actual when there were real cows that used to walk around. I mean, they would have these farms, and oftentimes wondered why the cows didn't try to escape or anything. But these farms would grow the cattle, and they'd feed them and they'd water them. But in water alone, the amount of water that cattle need in order to survive is just brutal. So not only was it ethical for them not to, you know, have meat there, but it was a practicality thing. They couldn't afford to keep cattle because there wasn't a way to, the amount of food they consumed versus the amount of food they produced wasn't feasible for New Rome. So that was one of the reasons why it became a vegetarian city. And rather than have people import, I mean, if you brought food, no one really care if you went out to these festivals. But, I mean, on the whole, the festivals were geared, we're kind of getting away from the whole meat thing, away from the, you know, the consuming of others, that type of thing. It became this place to go where you could have these amazing experiences. People would go out there and do artwork in the middle of the desert. It was just incredible. Well, it was becoming a desert pretty rapidly. This was the birth of the wastelands. So people would venture out from the cities. Of course, there's lots of drugs there. I mean, people brought out, you know, they're going out there in the middle of nowhere to whoop it up, you know. People would die out there, you know, because they partied too hard and they'd perish or whatever. And no one really, like, the bodies were just taken away. I mean, it wasn't that common. It wasn't like it was, you know, 10 people died a night. But, you know, he started by doing about 4 festivals a year, you know, just at different seasons. There was the spring, summer, fall, winter festivals. And, you know, there might be a couple people who drank themselves to death or whatever. And they were just sort of taken away, you know. It was never really played up because they knew if the government got a hold of the fact people were dying, they'd shut them down. But because the war was going on, they knew that they wouldn't have too much to worry about with the government because the government had other things to focus on. And, well, having a place where people could leave the cities when everything was turning to hell was good for morale on the public side. So the government tried not to stick their nose in it too much. The city itself was like a self-fulfilling, self-propagating structure. His price to come out there and party on his land and to do all this was both building materials and labor. His building materials could be anything. Like, people from all over would show up with anything from lumber to pipes to wires to spooling. And he put it all on his New Rome website, you know, the materials people needed to bring and what were in demand. But the big easy thing that everyone brought was cars, because you had to drive out there for one thing, but it would be easy to tow, you know, a couple of scrap vehicles, because at that time there's so many, you know, cars that couldn't afford to have waste cast conversion. So cars were everywhere. So everyone just towed out 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 cars. So a lot of things inside of New Rome were actually made from cars, from these vehicles that, you know, the waste of the living world. They drag cars out there and they'd paint them up with rust-proof paints, and usually in bright colors, and they'd strip everything out of the car that they could use in construction. The chairs inside the vehicles, the seats became furniture, and eventually became the seats of the Colosseum, which was the first main... Well, there was two major structures to begin with, but I'll get into that in a minute. And they'd strip all the wiring out and weave it together to make cable and rope, and it became a... It sounds like an amazing kind of a work party, but it was. There was two parts to each seasonal festival. There was the work, what they called the work season, and then the play season, which was... It started out being like a week and a week, and then it went to 2 weeks and 2 weeks and 3 weeks and then 3 weeks and whatever. You know, it kind of moved on like that till eventually it got to be where, you know, close to 2 months. There was like, you know, the place was only supposedly unoccupied for a month, where Caesar went through and did clean up and things like that. It was but people felt better about working out there. It's almost like the work part of it and the building of the city was almost more popular than the partying end of it. I mean, a lot of these people who came out there to work had never worked with their hands before. I mean, these were all guys from the coding pits, and building onto a city let them see a tangible result, let them see something that they never even knew could be possible come into being. Now, the major areas of construction, of course, was, you know, everyone brought out trailers, and some of people left them there, part of the dream, you know. Wow, this is a structure now, I brought this trailer out, and as long as I can use it next time I come back, that'll be great, you know. And or they build temporary structures, but they started building the Colosseum, and the Colosseum started as like a... Well, sort of a central area, a place where they could party, and there was a huge open area, you know, larger than any sports field, that was left to be, you know, this just an area to do whatever you wanted, a rave or what have you. And this became known as the New Rome Colosseum. And between that and, of course, for security purposes, there was the wall. I mean, originally, I think the wall started out just being kind of an artistic thing. Having this huge wall of cars was, you know, there was no guns at that time. It was just a wall of cars. It was like some structure in the middle of nowhere. You know, it was amazing. And in the beginning, he had his laws and rules that he kept, and the people came out there. This wasn't like you didn't have the gangs that you had today. This was all... It was all out of respect, you know, like Caesar invited people to come out, and as the popularity grew because of the party seasons and all that, he had to make sure that people just didn't show up for the play season and weren't there for the work season. So just like anything else, any other research he asked for, security, he asked for, you know, bouncers from the cities and the megas and whatnot to come out and work there to make sure that, you know, certain people got in. And being as there were so many people that were into technology, there's a whole identification system, and bio-identity came into play, and the whole thing became fairly state-of-the-art. I mean, it was featured in a lot of different magazines. People thought it was amazing. They could go out and, you know, that there was this communal technological world being built. And on the surface, what was in the magazines was the... you know, the technology, the communal, and the community, and the, you know, hooray for us kind of a thing that they kind of played off with the war. But the lifeblood of the place was the parties, really. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of work being done, but, you know, there's open orgies and drugs and debauchery to a level that, you know, was never seen before. I mean, not since Rome, you know. And that drew a lot of people, and there's people who go out and they'll do a lot of stuff to become part of a society like that because they enjoy it. That hedonistic mentality was what called them forward. This grew and grew and grew for years, and the New Rome began to build, and eventually it got sort of angular and circular. They finished up the wall, and it was becoming, you know, quite a thing. It reached its maximum potential without evolving. Which so many, like, just like anything else, any living organism, you know, you'll advance to a point and you have to either die or evolve. You enhance yourself to move on. Which is kind of like where I'm at right now. That's probably why I think that the Dread Man will be able to help me. But yeah, just like people, you get to a point where you need to either advance or stop, march or die. And that's what happened with New Rome. You see, they reached a point where they had to have something happen. And it was one festival that these, well, they called themselves Druids, but they came down from the Northwest, and they were like these, they weren't Druids in the, they were a weird kind of bastardized, well, I mean, what religion's bastardized? All religions are bastardized, you know, but they were this strange cross between, there used to be a race of beings known as the Druids who were in Ireland and in Europe, but these ones were these, they were like from the Mediterranean and Haiti and Jamaica. They were these Rastafarian Druids. It was, they called themselves Druids, but it was the way they moved. I mean, they had the long dreadlocks, and they began to, they came down and they really believed in what they were doing with New Rome. They thought it was ordained by God. They had a lot of these really, really wild ideas, and they came down and they came to party, and they got a hold of Caesar, and they gave him some bogweed. And bogweed is, well, I mean, at that time it was, bogweed is, it's like marijuana or pot or grass or any of those kind of drugs, but it's what they claim, what the Druids claim, was that it was the, just like people. How do you explain this? See, there was marijuana and grass, and it's all essentially the same thing, but if you understand anything about the drug culture at that time, there was different strains, like different species, like having a flower. You'd have different types of flowers, where there was different types of marijuana. And what they claimed was that this particular strain that they'd, in their culture and their religion, that they bred, was the closest to the original form. It was the ancient sacred herb that they believed was the salvation of man. It was an enhancement to them. They could say, well, they said that it would take them and enhance them in such a way that they'd be able to see all things and be able to speak with God. Now, the other side of that, aside from the sacred properties used in religion, was that bongweed could be made into cloth, could be made into gas, you could eat it, you could make it into food. I mean, you could make paper out of it. You could do everything with this essential weed. It was just a weed that would grow, and you could do all these things with it for relatively low resource cost. You just needed some dirt and a bit of water, and you were laughing. Now, the technology that went behind bogweed was, well, it, I mean, it had been repressed since long before the war. And there were books that talked about it that said that, you know, you could take marijuana and make food, medicine, you could make gasoline from it. But all these other industries who were reliant upon, you know, that their totally cost and cursive ways of raising gasoline by mining or whatever, their industry were depended upon not having a new product on the market, so they suppressed that information. But when New Rome came into being, it opened the Druids saw an advantage to bring bongweed into a, well, into a whole new beginning, into a new world, into a way so that everyone could partake of it, a gateway, if you will, to mainstream it, to bring it out so that people could go to New Rome and take part in a culture that, well, it, that was based spiritually in the Druids' faith. So they came down and they got a hold of Caesar and they, well, they let him, of course, I guess you could say they got him high or they enhanced him or something, but whatever it was they did, it worked. And he let them set up shop and he set up their labs and they began to grow the bongweed. Now, you got to bear in mind that this wasn't just a cover for some sort of drug trade. This was really a spiritual thing. They really believed that this herb, this natural occurring grass, was a solution to everything, that was their religion. And they began giving it away. When people would come out to party there, they had this stuff, and they would pump its essence through the air of the Colosseum. And I mean, since everything was more or less covered because of sheets of fabric and everything, to provide shade, because bear in mind, you know, the ozone layer was gone, that provided shade, but it also created a bit of a seal, so this essence that was floating through the air, everyone was, well, they were all becoming enhanced. Now you can imagine what kind of a, I mean, this place was a wild place to party before, but imagine that now they have this narcotic which is pumped through the air, and if it's not strong enough to get you high just from contact, I mean, it was given away for free. There was these clerics of druids who'd walk around and hand the stuff out. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And on top of that, there was, instead of having it done in seasons, it was done in, like, shifts. You would work and play and work and play, and you'd work making food, and then you'd have your time off. And the whole time, you know, you were kind of sedated and enhanced by the bong weed. As you can imagine, the growth that came from this was exponential. The city started to just explode. New Rome had more growth in the 5 years following than in the 10 years it was before that. The war was still raging, and the government turned a blind eye to what was happening because, well, again, you know, anything that was a distraction. With that much growth, the scrap vendors wanted to move in, you know. They wanted to really set up, because they saw so many people there, they would send out their trucks and be able to set up the vending machines, these waste tech, that kind of crowd. But the problem was is that they'd send out their vending machines and their trucks, and, well, the trucks would wind up part of the wall, the employees would jump ship and join with the New Romans and denounce their companies and give everything to this great cause. If you still look with a set of binos on the wall, you can see shattered and burned out sections of vending machines. This is, of course, before they started putting explosives in. It didn't take the vendors long before they realized that, you know, New Rome was not a place for the vendors market. So things were looking up. Everything was at peace, and the city was growing. The bong weed was there. But then they got to another tier. They got to another point where the spiritual implication of the druids and all that, and with the growth, that's when the infighting started. There's people had their own ideas about how things should be run, how they began questioning Caesar's rule. I mean, before it was just a guy on his property, but now, because there were so many people, they were like, no, New Rome shouldn't be a dictatorship, and they started having all these ideas about democracy and all this kind of jazz. Caesar had a good thing here. He didn't want to have it wrecked by a bunch of these folks who were going to take away his dream. Over the years, he'd allowed a child to be born from one of the orgies. It was his. And it's never known who the mother was, but he took this daughter, and that was to be his heir, his princess. And she's the current princess of New Rome, Princess Sabitha. And she will inherit all of New Rome one day. But because of these people, these usurpers who were trying to, you know, set up this way of taking control, there came a time when he couldn't allow that anymore. He couldn't allow to have these political activists in his city, because after all, it was a private city. It was his city. So he had to do something. And that was when he created the New Roman Templars. Before, the security forces were just, well, bouncers and some ex-military who came back on leave and stayed. But when he created the New Roman Templars, they're an order unto themselves. They're mostly, well, almost all of them are soldiers who took an oath to enforce the will of Caesar. Like it was the will of God. I mean, they were all, you know, heavy bong weed users, and they knew that they'd seen being a soldier is in a unique lifestyle, because you get to see how life exists inside of so-called democracy and communism. You see governments all over the world at their worst. And to the soldiers, following one man's rule was a lot like the military, so it made sense to them. And so they followed his orders. And the New Roman Templars do not question the will of Caesar. So, in a matter of days, the people who were creating problems in New Rome were gone. People said they left or they'd gotten fed up, but the truth was known that they were buried out in the desert somewhere. The Templars moved through it and slaughtered them. This, at the time, was would have caused any society growing to be infuriated, but the truth of the matter was with all the bong weed in the air and the free use of the narcotics, no one really wanted to stand up. They were just kind of complacent. The same way it was when he started it, how, you know, the stress and everything that was there that brought the creation of New Rome, he created that again, and now the stress was starting to build, so, but he'd already had the bong weed in place, so the people just kind of went along with it. Any unrest that he did have, he focused the attention on allowing fights in the Colosseum. Like the old Roman saying, give them bread and circus and the people will be happy. And this opened a whole new source of revenue as well. The Colosseum, of course, I mean, by this time had grown massive. It was this huge stadium with binocular posts, and people would look down into these this huge field where, you know, they'd have these fights, and they had barricades and all sorts of it changes from time to time, obstacles set up where they would have, unlike championship fights in the past where they'd have one-on-one, sometimes they do that, but they'd have like one-on-one fighting on like a steel beam that fell 200 feet to the earth, or they'd have 10 people fighting 10 people with swords. I mean, it was unreal bloodshed, and the government didn't really mind, but they couldn't say anything if they did mind, because well, Caesar had signed a contract with a few of the networks to allow them to televise this on pay-per-view events. So as powerful as government was at this time, the core politicals who stood to make huge money from these staged gladiatorial combats, the government couldn't move in on it. They couldn't stop it because of the interest that the core politicals held and the governmental funding. So that was probably the point when things, well, maybe it was when the Druids moved in, but that was when New Rome really started to grow dark. The soldiers enforce his will now, and they become his the Templars, the New Roman Templars are unbelievable. Now the laws maintained in the city by snipers who sit on top of key points with these rifles, these 20 millimeter rifles that have it's an amazing well, it's they're high end mil-spec snipers who they have a complete scope out system, and they watch the city for what they consider to be any act of violence too extreme, and they'll just fire. I mean, it's the word of law is just instant. There's no trial. They just, people are just shot, so they know not to fight. And if you go inside of a building, well, the scope technology they have follows thermal and sound. You can't hide from these rifles. That's the reigning law. But anyway, that's where what that evolved to now. But at that time, the fights in the Colosseum was the next stage of the evolution of New Rome. As there was no rules, there was no governing body on them, so you brought people from all over the world, and when you have that kind of bloodlust and that kind of combat, well, it's only standard that you're going to start getting big money stakes involved, and betting and gambling. Now, because of the gambling, more and more money was coming into play. And with that kind of power, well, corruption wasn't far behind. The highest stakes, pretty quick, for any odds on any match anywhere in the world became in the New Roman arena. The New Roman gladiators, who, well, were became famous. I mean, to be a new Roman gladiator mean that you were the best of the best. And while in New Rome, you lived like a god while outside of the ring. Anything you wanted was free. You just walked around and, you know, I mean, you were the one to be desired at orgies. You were anything you wanted, the best food, whatever you wanted was there. And while inside the ring, you'd fight to the death for it. Now, the last revolutionary stage came when the barter system, which everything was based upon up to that point, everything was all done in bartering, was becoming awkward because of the growing populace of New Rome. The wall was forever expanding. They would tear down a section of the wall and move it out so that it would move out in like triangles, huge angled triangles that would just grow out and grow out, and there's always under construction, even to this day. But with this barter system becoming awkward, the populace was permitted to bring in its final play. This is the thing that made really the populace in New Rome essentially slaves. He created a thing called a New Roman credit that was used to augment barter. Now, there was no real money involved here, but because he'd already had the groundwork laid for security and keeping track of who was who in the city, it was nothing to put on a credit. If you did something, you were paid in New Roman credits. But these credits, of course, were only useful in New Rome. But to prevent him from, well, to prevent anyone from turning it into just another capitalistic state, he used these New Roman credits to augment barter. And if you were ever caught hoarding New Roman credits, then you'd be charged by treason by greed under New Roman law. So, for example, let's say, let's say you've got a bunch of seeds that I want to take from you, or I want to purchase from you, but all I have is a pencil. Well, if I trade you this pencil and for the seeds, it's not fair. But if I trade you the pencil for the seeds and I throw, you know, 30 New Roman credits on it, then that's a little bit more useful. And this then led to the law of New Rome and the economic laws of New Rome, where they have justicars who wander around and make sure that business is not being hoarded, because they can at a moment's notice look through and see how many credits are associated to different people. And if ever you get too much credits and not enough barter, or even just too much credits, you'll just be charged with treason by greed and executed. So it was handy because people wouldn't be able to leave New Rome because the credits, they have so much credit there, and their barter, well, it's useless anywhere else. So once you became a citizen of New Rome, you were kind of enslaved there. You had to stay and work in that society because you couldn't leave. It was an interesting way of doing business. Very smart. And Caesar, either through the use of the bong weed or maybe through his counsel that he kept in his court, was growing wiser and wiser, or maybe more and more insane, depending on how you look at it. His power was growing unbelievably by this point, and to the point where it is now, where it's called the Lost City, because the core politicals can't stop it. It's an alternative nation that utilizes any technology they want. You can still go there with technology you bring, and you can give it away, and there's that sort of feel everywhere you go where people are calling each other brother, and it's filled with wonder and honor. Yet just below the surface, there's a lot of horror and violence, bloodshed, hedonism, debauchery, all ruled by Caesar and enforced without question by the ex-soldiers and the military monks who became the new Roman Templars. There was only ever one instance when the new Roman Templar didn't enforce Caesar's will. That's another story. That's an interesting story, actually. But to tell you about that, I got to tell you about the Pathfinder Project. See, this is another one of those legends that a lot of people didn't know if it was true or not, but I know it was true. The Pathfinder Project was one of the infamous super soldier solutions that the government thought up. This was a government thing. This wasn't an out-farmed contract job. This was an actual government-sponsored project. It was named after the Pathfinder course, which is actually the hardest course available to any individual soldier involved in the NATO bloc, which was a coalition bloc between countries before the Great War. the course itself was designed to make individuals who could operate independently behind enemy lines. They could throw them out of a plane in deep enemy territory and then pick them up again in about 6 months, and they'd, you know, have a complete reconnaissance of an area. They'd know the locals. They probably already started training the locals to be guerrillas. They were perfect military units, and they were called Pathfinders. But the Pathfinder project was, well, it came in just after, you know, the introduction of the Aikido Mass and that training. The government saw that they could train men mentally while hooking their bodies up to machines that would alter them physically. So they said, what if we were to try to, well, create the super soldier this way? Because we could completely train their environment and put them through the hardest imaginable trials and see what they'd get. And it was a 5-year project, and God knows how many millions, maybe even billions of dollars went into it. But, you know, the call went out throughout all the forces, and they did their standard selection and made it to 1,000 men. And over 5 years, they strapped these men into machines that altered their mind and their body. And they did it at half time. So for every 1 day of their life was 2 days of, you know, of actual time. And these 1,000 men spent 5 years hooked up into the Aikido Mass, into the machine, where they were put through the most unimaginable, grueling combat simulations and missions. It was so bad, and with the body alteration and everything that came to pass, that out of 1,000 men, most of them died. It said that there were less than 50 men who made it through the course, which of course made the men who made it were, well, they were legend. They weren't even considered to be soldiers anymore. They were these killing machines. They were the super soldiers. But of course, the cost of production was astronomical. I mean, what, are you going to take 5 years to create less than 50 men who, although were effective, were independent operatives? No, that's crazy. It was too much money. But they'd invested too much money into these super soldiers to kill them. So they scattered them into different stasis tanks and dropped them into deep storage on different bases all over the United States, and the whole project was wrapped up. Kind of forgotten about. Except for a hunter named Damon Milton. Now you gotta understand that because the Colosseum, the New Roman Colosseum, well, the gladiators were experienced combat veterans, there wasn't always people for them to fight. So they opened it up, big money, towards, well, what they were called was owners, but in actuality they were slavers. They would go out, they would find these people, jack them with hostility drugs or any kind of the military aggression factors, throw them in the arena to get chewed up, and win, lose, or draw, these agents would wind up getting paid for it. Well, a hunter, who is a kind of an agent, but he's sort of a wasteland scrapper. It's just a general term for merchants who do a lot of deep wasteland exploration for profit. There was a hunter, this Damon Milton guy, had heard of the Pathfinder Project, and he knew of a base where he believed that one existed, and he found some old data files and really thought that there was an unactivated Pathfinder sitting in a stasis tank somewhere in a deep forgotten storage bin. So he went out, went into the wastelands, and found him on an old abandoned base. Now, these stasis tanks were good for thousands of years. I mean, these were things that were designed for, they were practically cryogenics. So he just revived this Pathfinder who, I mean, saying he was revived is probably the wrong term. It might be better to say he was activated, even though he was still biological. But I mean, he was they don't have the same desires or even thought process that a living human man does. So he activated this Pathfinder and told him that he was Commander Damon Milton and that he was now under his command, which the Pathfinder took because he was the one who activated him. And that was part of their programming, so it was no problem. So he took this Pathfinder down to the New Roman Arena and said, yeah, I got a guy who'll take on some gladiators, no problem. Well, the first few battles ended really, really quickly because, well, the other gladiators, even though they were popular soldiers, weren't anything to this Pathfinder, so he slaughtered them. Killed them outright. The match was over in seconds. So, every time he won, of course, Commander Damon Milton there, he was getting paid. So the odds started to stack against him. They started putting two gladiators against him, and then four. Eventually, they had like walls of 50 men going out there with swords. Now, the rules of the arena are pretty simple. You're not allowed to use any ranged weapon, not even thrown. You can use nets, crowbars, swords, chainsaws, whatever you want. You just can't use ranged weapons. No bows, no throwing stars, no... If you use an axe and you throw it, you're shot. But you can use an axe. So they sent legions against this guy. The thing is, you can only be attacked, I believe it's by 6 or 8 people at a time, so... And he'd had 5 years, plus God only knows how long he'd gone over his drills in stasis. But, I mean, he was slaughtering, killed hundreds and hundreds of these gladiators. So many that they were starting to run out, and the guy they brought in to be cannon fodder was turning everyone else into cannon fodder and didn't even look tired. The arena was going insane. The people were cheering for him, and even Caesar knew this soldier was undefeatable. This was something he'd never seen before. But he had to show his own superiority. Caesar had to show that he was the one in charge here, because he couldn't let this soldier become something else. He couldn't let him become a hero figure. It gets kind of political pretty quickly. So he asked the Pathfinder. He stood up after a battle and he'd killed dogs, he'd killed everything. And he called the Pathfinder forward, and the Pathfinder approached, and from his high position he said that, he would ask this soldier, he said that he commended him for his bravery and blah, 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 blah. And he said that, you must surrender your weapon. You are truly amazing. Well, the problem was is that Caesar used the word surrender, and that's not really on with the whole Pathfinders. So what the Pathfinder said was, I am a Pathfinder. There is no surrender. I only answer to Commander Damon Milton. Now, to defy Caesar in front of the crowd was an offense punishable by death. And Caesar was furious. And silently, under his breath, he gave the order to shoot. But the Templars, the New Roman Templars, stayed their hand. They wouldn't fire. Because they were soldiers of war. Well, and even in their cold hearts, even the Roman Templars were in awe of this guy's prowess, and they didn't fire. Now, that put Caesar in big trouble, because now he's got his own guard are standing against him because they won't fire on this soldier who they respect. So he was in a bad, bad way here. He was at the risk of losing it all. Loss of power. Perceived power is achieved power. And if you've perceived loss, that's a real loss. And it was his daughter that saved him. She saw what was happening. And by this time, she was about, I'd say 14, maybe 15 years old, but every bit as shrewd as Caesar was. She saw what was happening. She jumped up and over the microphone because, well, the booth is mic'd for Caesar making a speech. She begs her father to spare the Pathfinder's life because he was so valiant. All this was broadcast around the arena, and the crowd's loving this. She sees, the new Roman sweetheart, Princess Sabitha, begging for the life of this valiant, gladiator, this Pathfinder. Now, Caesar was no dummy. He saw what his daughter was doing, and he accepted that this man should be spared because of his daughter's begging. So he sent for this commander, Damon Milton, and, Damon Milton, who was making good money at the time, was now getting a little bit freaked out. And the Templars made it kind of clear to him that he was to give command of the Pathfinder over to Caesar if he wanted to leave New Rome alive. So, this commander, Damon Milton, over the microphone to the crowd's riotous cheering, gave the command of the Pathfinder not to Caesar, but to the command of the Pathfinder was given to his daughter, Sabatha, so that he would serve as her bodyguard. And that's where the Pathfinder is to this very day. So, Princess Sabatha of New Rome is, shall we say, rather well defended. And now the Pathfinder stands in the court of Caesar at his shielded underground dwelling. Another oddity in the treasure chest of the New Rome. Just like the Dreadmen I'm going to go see. That's a legend anyway, that's what they say. Like I said, you know, none of this is written down, and, well, the whole thing could be propaganda as far as I know, but they say that it was those who saw it, who saw this Pathfinder in action, and, I mean, like I said, he's not a man, he's a instrument of death. I gotta tell you, I'm pretty excited about about my little trip into this place. Out of all my travels, I've never been to a place like New Rome. Well, I don't think there is another place like New Rome. I mean, the druids still pump their drugs into the air, and the whole place is like one gigantic, never-ending, decadent, extreme dwelling life. The whole place is alive. Not even Prophet would try to storm this being that is New Rome, controlled by the neural center that is Caesar. I mean, the whole thing is just... It takes it to another level. It's like you're leaving this world and entering another one. And that's where the Dreadman keeps his court. I don't know his name. I'm going to have to find that out when I get in there. But I've heard stories about... Well, the Dreadman is one of the druids. But I don't know much. I'm going to have to see what I can find out once I hit the city. Until then, though, I'm going to try to get some sleep. Avoid the heat of the day, and I'll move into the city at night. And I'll be sure to get back to you with everything I learn. But until next broadcast, this is Independent Librarian Dynamic Sean Kennedy VI doing a pirate broadcast of episode number 732.653.663.398.36.13 in Queen's English from sometime after now. I hope that the knowledge that you get, knowledge that I don't even think people in the, even here, have knowledge of New Rome. I think the knowledge that I'll be able to share with you will help us, will help you and maybe help the future. And with the knowledge you possess, you'll be able to please. I hope you'll help me.
Hi there, this is Sean Kennedy. If you liked this episode of Tales from the Afternow, and you'd like to download the others for free, you can do it at www.theafternow.com. If you'd like to support Tales from the Afternow, you can make a donation there as well. Thank you.